in a lot of ways, we're sort of deconstructing and reorienting meanings around relationships, right? And those come from all sorts of places. This comes from society, from movies, from the friends that we witness when we go out to dinner with them. They come from the families that we grew up in, you know, from what we learned in our classrooms, like all different kinds of places, right? And so part of having the language of neurodiversity and being able to say there's something about these relationships that's different from neurotypical relationships is that we get to say we can hold on to all of that, right? All these other meanings that have been given to us or that we've learned or been taught from other people, but we get to challenge it. We get to ask ourselves, is that really what we want to believe about relationships universally? Or are there different meanings we want to make out of the relationship we have with each other?
Hello and welcome. I'm Abby. This is Stories Lived, Stories Told. And today, I invite you to join me in conversation with Lori Budlong Morse as we take a communication perspective on neurodivergence in relationships. To take a communication perspective is to consider what we're making and how we're making it through our communication practices. This means we look closely at patterns, context, stories, and relationships, and that we use curiosity, mindfulness, collaboration, and dialogue to create better social worlds. So whether the topic of today's conversation is familiar to you or not, the hope is that using a communication perspective will reveal new ways of seeing and being for all of us. At the top of the episode, you heard our conversation partner today, Lori Budlong Morse. Lori is a licensed marriage and family therapist and an AANE certified neurodiverse couples therapist with a private practice in Indianapolis. You can read more about her and find ways to connect in the show notes I've included on this episode. This episode is the second in our series of conversations with therapists. And although the conversations this month are wide-ranging, I'm calling this series the Relationships series because I realize that what is at the core of all of these conversations is considering how we show up to ourselves and others and what we create together. In this conversation, Lori and I are exploring relationships that include neurodiverse individuals and what she calls mixed neurotype couples in her work as a marriage and family therapist. This conversation feels important to me because more and more people are identifying as neurodivergent. The stories that we are allowing ourselves to tell about what meaning we're making and how we're showing up in the world are becoming more and more expansive. And to me, that's a really exciting thing. And even if you or those you interact with do not identify as neurodiverse, there is still so much to learn for all of us about accommodating many different ways of being. That's what dialogue is, whether it's specifically in a neurodiverse context or not. So I'm really excited to share this conversation with you today. So let's jump in with Lori. Hello, Lori. Thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. I've so been looking forward to speaking with you.
Hello, Abby. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it too.
I'm just so excited to learn from you. And so before I get ahead of myself, though, let's start with you and then get into your work. Can you introduce yourself? Tell us whatever parts of yourself you'd like to share that feel kind of relevant for this conversation today or feel like good context for us to know you.
Sure. I'm going to start with a little bit about who I am professionally, and then I'm going to connect that a little bit to who I am personally as well. So I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and that means I practice therapy. I'm a private practice therapist, but it also means that I'm what we call a systemic thinker. So I'm somebody who's always thinking about people in the context of systems around them, whether those systems are their relationships, the people kind of in their immediate context, or even like the larger context of our culture as a system and the ways that impacts language and what we expect of each other and all those good things. So that's kind of the broadest umbrella of who I am professionally. More specifically, I specialize in working with neurodiverse couples and folks who are in neurodiverse relationships. And so that means for folks who don't know that term, we also sometimes refer to to these couples as mixed neurotype couples. So it's couples where one partner, or maybe even both partners, either has ADHD or is autistic or some combination of both. Sometimes we've got OCD thrown in there too, some other neurological pieces. So that's really the focus of who I am professionally. And then personally, there's so many different pieces here, but the pieces I want to emphasize is that I grew up in a neurodiverse family. So there was both autism and ADHD present in the family that I grew up in. And then I've created a neurodiverse family of my own. I have a spouse with ADHD and a child with ADHD. My own brain, I would define as more neurotypical than anything else, but I'm really influenced by the fact that I grew up in a neurodiverse family culture, and I often find myself drawn to neurodivergent people. And there's a lot about neurodivergent folks that I really appreciate and find, you know, just super beneficial and interesting to be around. So in addition to those pieces, I think another really important identifier about who I am as a person is I like to think of myself as a student of self-compassion. I've done a lot of work. I've worked really hard over the last number of years to really learn who I am and to be more accepting of that, and to have a relationship with myself that's more defined by compassion and warmth and understanding of myself. And I could also throw in there, I'm sort of a recovering performer, somebody who felt pretty driven by achievement. And now I feel much more driven by, you know, being in good relationship with myself and with the people around me. So it's a work in progress, but that's important to me.
Yeah. Well, that resonates with me as well, for sure. I love the concept from meditation of this kind of like non-judgmental awareness. And that non-judgmental piece being so key for me and how I am, which sounds like maybe how you are describing yourself as a recovering performer, that I've been very achievement and, you know, success, whatever, you know, you would define that as, but performing well, achieving, focused. And so that means a lot of values statement, a lot of judgment statements, the way that I'm talking to myself. So that's very cool to hear. And we should talk about that more. To stick with your stories, I'm already hearing you say this a little, that there's this really strong connection between your personal world and your work world. Could you talk to that a little more and share? Maybe there are some specific stories of what are the experiences that you've had that made you want to do what it is that you do now, or really that make you feel passionate about doing what you do too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a big question. It's a wonderful
yes.
Of it. I mean, I think for me, probably the primary driver, there's so many like things that web off from this, but about 5 years ago, I went through a process of recognition around my mother that I came to recognize that she was autistic. And that was just so revolutionary for me in so many ways. I think that really, like I said, there was something about myself that I understood after that I just could never name before. And all this kind of language and the sense of being able to see my family and see myself really grew out of that. And I mean, I'd already been a therapist for a number of years at that point. I'd already been in my own therapy for a number of years at that point. So it's not like I hadn't already been really trying hard to sort of have this self-awareness and this good relationship with myself and other people. But I just kept feeling like there's something I don't know, or there's something I don't understand. And it was troubling to me at some level. It was usually in the background, but there were times it would kind of come to the foreground where I'd either sit with a client or, you know, be journaling about something and be like, wait, how come what they're saying doesn't fit anywhere in my experience? Or like, how come when I go to describe my own experience, even in like the privacy of my journal writing, I still feel like I'm struggling to believe myself or to know what I really mean? So that whole journey was just so really freeing for me. And it just brought to my attention so many ways in which folks in neurodiverse relationships and for autistic in particular, like how there's just so much marginalization, so much lack of awareness, lack of appropriate and knowledgeable support in our wider context. And I found myself wanting to be able to give back from what I'd learned. But I also just, it's so powerful to get to witness other people do that work that feels, like I said, it feels really liberatory in a number of different ways. And so it's so meaningful to get to witness that. And then it keeps me continuing to come back to my own work too.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, at the very beginning, you said that you came from a neurodiverse family. Were there other elements of that and you knew that growing up, or is this the moment that you're talking about right now where you kind of looking back were able to say retroactively, I was in a neurodiverse family, but I didn't know it at the time?
Yeah, it's much more retroactive. At that point, I had a sibling who was diagnosed with ADHD and I knew that. But I mean, at that point in time, and really this is up until pretty recently, but a lot of the conversation about ADHD was like, oh, that impacts school.
Yeah.
Right. It was sort of this idea of like, oh, it's somebody that you know, has certain things that make school difficult, but if they take medication, then that gets better. And that's all we need to know about ADHD. Right. So it wasn't like we really had any conversation as a family about what that might mean in terms of how the sibling, you know, interacted with us on camping trips or, you know, just things on the weekend or the foods they like to eat. You know, we never had any kind of understanding of that. And then my dad often would say, after my sibling got diagnosed, he would kind of say, oh, I think maybe I have ADHD. And he would sort of like tell stories from childhood or muse on that a little bit. But again, it was never something that was really brought to the foreground or talked about in any way, context really, other than, again, kind of school. And then I also want to say that when I met my husband, I knew from the start of our relationship that he had ADHD. And so that was kind of part of our relationship from early on too. But it wasn't until I put the pieces together with my mom and I really started digging into like, what is neurodiversity and like, how all does it show up? And again, with like the diagnosis of my own child with ADHD too, where I really started recognizing like, oh, there's things about all these different pieces that have been important, right? And that have kind of influenced how I relate to these various important people in my life that also, yeah, impacts me and it's given me some different tools in terms of how I show up with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the language piece of this. That's, you know, kind mm-hmm. of where I exist, is that I think that having the right language to talk about something is so empowering. I also know that, you know, maybe overly prescriptive labels are disempowering, yeah. But it sounds like from your experience, and I wonder if you could share more about that, or even if you've seen it in the people you work with, of how having the language to be able to talk about the neurodiversity, to, you know, call out these things, these dynamics that are real and have the language for it. If you could speak more to how that you have seen that be empowering and important for people.
Yeah, I think that's so huge. Yeah. So I like to use the language of autism as a framework for self-understanding. For example, or autism as a framework for understanding a partner, or we might say ADHD as a framework for self-understanding or for understanding a child or a partner or mm-hmm. a parent, you know? And so I feel like when we have that label, I think for me, I never think about it as like, I don't know, this is what a person is or isn't. I think about it as a map for how can we understand how this person experiences the world, right? And how they respond to the world, and how can that person better understand themselves, and how can those of us around them better understand them? And so I think, like I said, I really feel like the work has a lot of liberation in it. And what I consistently see is when people use autism or ADHD as a framework for self-understanding, I'll start with that one, it opens up space to be so much more self-accepting, to find solutions that actually work instead of just relying on like shaming and criticizing yourself constantly. It provides even kind of connection to other people who have similar lived experiences. You know, it just orients you to so much about who you are. And, you know, for folks on the other side of that, who now have a framework to understand someone else in their lives, which is, again, you know, my lived experience is, I think this ability to have, again, more acceptance and compassion, to really see somebody for who they are and not for what they do or don't do. It helps us reframe so many different things that in our neurotypically normed world we view as quote unquote like bad or unacceptable or, you know, not preferred in relationships. And so there's so much freedom, I think, too, when you can look at somebody that you love and that you've always thought had the best of intentions or had your best interest in mind, but they've sometimes fallen short or disappointed you or confused you in different ways. And when you can understand who they really are in the context of their neurotype, it's so much easier just to see that care and that love, and that some of those actions or inactions are really about the way their brain works and not about how they feel about you.
Yeah. Yeah, you said it right at the beginning there and then brought it up at the end of the, what I'd say, a kind of like non-pathologizing is important. It's not who you are, or this is, you know, it is maybe more of like a function. Like you said, it's just about how their people's brains relate to the world. And there's not a, this is the right way and this is the wrong way. This is a good way. This is a bad way. It's just all different ways. And that language makes so much sense to me, because part of, you know, the communication theory that my work is rooted in, CMM, is about the meaning making. I'd say it's all about the meaning making. There's so many different layers, you know, that I could go into, but the piece that feels really central to me is meaning making. And I think it's because in my mind, having that as kind of like a framework, like you're saying, kind of offering it in that same way, if you can start to see meaning as something that's socially constructed, if you can start to see yourself as someone who gets to make meaning, and if you can start to grow more comfortable or confident in navigating the differences in meaning, then I think those are all such great tools for overcoming or avoiding problems that crop up in relationships, not maybe because someone is right or wrong or someone is being mean or something, but truly we are making meaning differently. And if we can have the language and put language to that, I just think that that is such a powerful tool for, I would imagine, people in neurodiverse relationships, but people in any relationships, that your brain is working differently and you are making meaning differently because you have been told different meaning, or you've lived different stories that have, you know, solidify different meanings in you. And so that's maybe that, yeah, the non-pathologizing labels or language, that's what's empowering, because it says, it validates, says there are many different ways of being, and we can all coexist and we can learn from each other and we can seek to understand each other with curiosity. And so the goal is not, oh God, there's so many ways of being, we need to whittle it down to one, so we're all comfortable. It's okay, how do we get comfortable in the many ways of being and kind of existing in that tension?
Yeah, absolutely. You are speaking my language. And right. In terms of what I see this work really being about is, this meaning making piece. And like you said, we're both, in a lot of ways, we're sort of deconstructing and reorienting meanings around relationships, right? And those come from all sorts of places. Those come from society, from movies, from the friends that we witness when we go out to dinner with them. They come from the families that we grew up in, you know, from what we learned in our classrooms, like all different kinds of places, right? And so part of having the language of neurodiversity and being able to say there's something about these relationships that's different from neurotypical relationships is that we get to say, we can hold on to all of that, right? All these other meanings that have been given to us or that we've been learned or been taught from other people, but we get to challenge it. We get to ask ourselves, is that really what we want to believe about relationships universally? Or are there different meanings we want to make out of the relationship we have with each other? And again, like you said, I think for a mixed neurotype couple, you know, some of what I say is like, this work just isn't optional for you. Like you have to do it, but really all couples should do it, right? We're all so, there's so much variation in terms of what it is to be human and what it means to love someone else. And we should all be empowered and we should all be intentional about asking ourselves, do our relationships really reflect what we want and what works for us and what honors and respects the person we're relating to? Or are we operating out of these assumptions, these meanings that have been handed down to us that might not actually be a good fit for our lived experience?
It makes sense that you say this is not optional work if you're in a mixed neurotype relationship. And it makes me think that, like I said earlier, like your work is so expansive in that numbers wise, I would think at some point all of us are going to have some kind of relationship or at least interaction with neurodiverse other individuals. And so it's kind of like, yeah, if you can have this framework, regardless of if your you know, closest people are neurodiverse or not, it's still going to serve you well. So I'm curious, we've kind of talked about these like overarching themes and, you know, hopes for the work that you do. Can you share a little bit more about what is actually at the heart of the work that you do and what does it look like? Because this is something that I'm not familiar, I'm familiar with therapy generally, but I'm curious to know specifically how you go about your work.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, some of what we've talked about already is something I talk about with clients. I mean, I sometimes put it into different language that's not quite as like nerdy as both of us are able to be about sort of communication and meaning making. But I very much bring this into the room all the time with clients is to name, you know, specific things about what our society tells us relationships should look like. And I help them ask themselves the question, like, is that what you actually need here? Or is that what you feel like you've been taught you're supposed to do? And there are some times where people will say, yeah, that is what I want. That is what I need. And we can affirm that and we can work with that. But there's other times where folks have said like, no, actually I'm fine with this. Like I can think of an example where a couple was sleeping in separate bedrooms. And I think we actually have some research now that indicates a lot of couples sleep in separate bedrooms, but we still have this like widely held idea that if you're in a partnered relationship and you're sleeping in separate rooms on a regular basis, that there's something wrong with your relationship. And, you know, being able to explicitly call out like, that's a choice you can make. And it's a choice that plenty of people make, and that's okay. And what do you really want here? You know, allowed somebody to recognize like, oh, I've been thinking about this as a problem and thinking we needed to fix it. But when I stop and think about it, I actually like this.
Yeah.
Like this works fine for me.
Yeah. I love that. It makes so much sense through the meaning making kind of framework. And like you called out there, really questioning, well, what are the stories? What's the meaning that's been handed down to me through whoever, you know, family, society, peers, whatever, because it kind of, I feel like in your work, maybe what you're offering people is the shift in like asking a different question or being oriented, not towards like, what should we do, but, or what should we want? But what do we want? Like what, or not what should work for us, but what does work for us? So if you're in your head, if you're answering the question, what should work for us, we should say, oh, sleeping in separate bedrooms in your, you know, romantic relationship, that shouldn't work for us. That shouldn't be what we aspire to. But if the question becomes, well, does it work for you? Like you're like, seems like your work is kind of like taking away that extra, I don't know, burden of the should. Yeah.
Have it. Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. And that I'm often thinking of myself as like listening for listening for assumptions and checking in with them. Like I sometimes say to clients, sometimes I ask you questions that sound like they have obvious answers, but I really mean it as a question, you know? So I'm often kind of listening for things like that, being like, well, wait, is that really a couple should sleep in the same bedroom? Like, where does that, are you sure about that? Like, where does that come from? And is that what really works for you? Right. So I'm often listening for those things where I'm like, people's thinking seems stuck in a way, and I'm not sure if what they're saying is what they really mean, right? Or if there's another way of looking at it or talking about it that might be better. So that's a big part of what I'm always doing. And along for that, we have a term in therapy, social construction therapy, that it's called listening for the absent but implicit. Right. So often when we're talking, and I'm sure maybe somebody is listening to our conversation right now and they're thinking, oh, there's something that you guys aren't saying, but it's implied somehow. Right. We often do this. We're always choosing what to say and what not to say. So that's another piece of meaning making, is I'm often listening for like, what aren't you saying that maybe needs to be said directly or asked directly? And again, that's often getting at some of those assumptions. But sometimes it's just getting at things that couples have learned not to say to each other or have learned they can't talk about, and giving them an opportunity to practice talking about that with someone and to find, oh, wait, we can name this directly. And now there's some more space that's opening up in terms of what else we can talk about or what kinds of solutions about this we can come up with.
Yeah. That makes me go back to CMM, in that there's, again, this is going to be my communication nerd coming out, but there's a model within CMM that's called the loop model, and that's L and then 5 U's and then 2 T's. And again, this is, you know, that kind of like nerdy language, but it is also like applicable in real life. And so I do like to share it, that the L stands for lived stories. And then the last T is the told story. So that's where the name of the podcast comes from, is stories, lived stories told. And then the other T is storytelling, the act of storytelling. And then the U's, which really could be infinite, represent all these other kinds of stories, stories that are untold, stories that are unheard, stories that are untellable, stories that are unknown, and stories that are undigested. Those are the 5 that are kind of canon right now, but again, could go on forever. And that's what I was hearing in what you're saying, is that what are the untold stories, or the unknown, or the unheard, which, you know, seem like kind of slight differences, but really do make, you know, if you truly don't know that a story exists, or if you're not, maybe someone else is trying to say something to you, but you're not really hearing it, or if you have an untold story in yourself, or thinking kind of like your systems thinking, you've talked about social construction, what are the stories that have not been told to me? And I think it's so important for, as we see ourselves, you know, in that like social constructionist light, as participants in our social world with choices to make things happen for ourselves, when it maybe like, it's about this like awareness as a first step, because if you can become aware of all the kinds of stories in the world and that you encounter, like you said, then you can get in the practice of asking that question, which is not just a practice for if you're a therapist. In any of your relationships, you can say, what are the untold stories?
Yeah.
Or that question you asked, you know, what's not being said here?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm kind of picturing this, like the lived stories, all the untold things, unknown things, and then like the told stories, right? And I think a lot of times for folks in these mixed neurotype relationships, like the gap between the lived and the told is like really wide, you know, because you're coming from this kind of marginalization in society in a lot of ways. But I think also because for so many of these couples, neurodivergence, neurodiversity wasn't identified at the start of their relationship. Like many times the couples that I'm working with, like they've been together for years, even decades, and they're just now kind of coming to this framework. And so when you don't have an accurate map, it's so hard to tell the story about what you're actually living, right? You're just sort of grabbing onto whatever you can find to tell the story. And it might be close enough, but it's not accurate. There's a lot of gaps kind of in between what you're really living and what you're telling yourself, and even what you're telling to your partner or telling to other people in your life about what's happening. And so, yeah, I love kind of thinking about all those yous in the middle, and that is a lot of what my work looks like. And I think sometimes people expect me to have an answer to this question that's a lot more, I don't know, concrete or structured in some way. And I'm like, there are some things I do that are more concrete. I could talk about that. But I really believe the most powerful thing I do with these couples is we work on all the untold, all the unknown, and finding language for that and finding ways to talk about it. And in that process, really getting out from under things both partners have learned about who am I supposed to be in relationship? Who am I supposed to be in this relationship in particular? We really get out from under all of that, and we start to create something together that's so much more intentional, so much more authentic, so much more respectful and compassionate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you're talking, I'm kind of visualizing now the loop model. If you think about it, like spatially, in that it is like the distance between the lived stories and the told stories is where the meaning making happens, first of all. And it's so taken for granted. And I feel like that to me seems like where you come in, like your work exists in that leap in between where you can say, okay, hang on, let's stay here for a second. And that, because I imagine that that's the heart of, you know, just misunderstandings in relationship is different meaning making that's not explicit. Yeah. Because if I take for granted, well, I just assume you're making the same meaning as me. So why in the world would you act like that? But if you can say, oh, I'm making meaning in this way, you know, this is what this action or this moment means to me. And this is why I'm reacting in this way. And then I can say, oh, this is what it means to me. And this is why I'm reacting in this way. And again, it's not, okay, well, you're wrong and I'm right. Mm-hmm. But okay, so how do we meet each other from these two different meanings that we've made?
Yeah, which is making me think about a story from my own relationship, which I have permission to tell, which is, you know, it's so seemingly small, but I think it's such a great example of what this process can look like, right? Is that my husband has this thing where he needs to leave his keys in a certain place. And as a person with ADHD, like this is one of the coping skills that he's learned over time, is like, it's really important to put his keys in the same place every time. Otherwise, it makes it like that much harder to leave the house. It just throws everything off for his brain if he can't just grab the keys from the place where they belong. Well, for so many years in our marriage, I am not a person who puts the keys in the same place. In fact, like my daughter, when she was really young, once like role play was like playing leaving the house and was like pretending, oh, where are my keys? Like was like part of the game of leaving the house. And so like, that's who I am, right? And that's how I deal with my keys. And that's just what works for me in my life. I mean, I am often looking for my keys, but it doesn't bother me. It's easier for me to look for the keys than to make sure I put them in the same place every time. It's just better for me. So for the longest time, I couldn't understand like what was so problematic about where I put the keys. Like there are so many things that I do well and help, you know, I'm helpful in so many different ways as a spouse. Like, why is this one thing like so just like difficult for my husband when I don't remember to do it? And it wasn't until I'd done more of this like neurodiversity work where I finally was like, oh, I really see that now, right? And he told me that before. He tried to explain to me before what made that important, but it wasn't until I really had this deeper understanding of neurodiversity and could build a better map of his experience that I really got like, oh, that's why this is so important to him, right? So that ability for me to tell myself a more accurate story was really helped by, you know, filling in all these blanks about ADHD. And our ability to sort of talk about that together and even find a little bit more humor in that situation or problem solve together around it really also has been helped by that as well.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you say that, because I realized that I'm sitting over here being like, just talk about the meaning. And it's no, like there's maybe like even some deconstructing that has to happen. Like you're saying, the questions that you ask the people you work with, if you say, well, is that actually what you want? Or is that what society's told you you should want? Some people maybe have never asked themselves that question. And so it's like, whoa, hang on, let me think about that. And then it is maybe like flexing this muscle you've never, ever worked before to say, let me articulate what meaning I'm making right now. It's actually such a learning process. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine that that's part of the work that you do. So I wonder if you can talk at all about the kind of reality of practicing, you know, mm-hmm. kind of existing in this way where you really have the space in a relationship for everybody's ways of being.
Yeah, I mean, I think it takes everybody being willing to really do their homework, right? To learn about neurodiversity, to learn about neurotypes, to learn about themselves. So I think that's a really big piece. I do think there's plenty of times where it does come down to talking about something really concrete. And when we think about couples therapy more broadly, which again, like that's my first training, right, is in just family systems theory and these really broad ways of thinking about couples relationship dynamics, we tend to have this preference for what we call process over content. So it's all about like help the couple talk about the way they're talking to each other instead of the topic that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. That makes sense, right?
Yes, yes.
But you cannot do that with a mixed neurotype couple. You just cannot. It's not helpful. It's, you know, really a way in which this work needs to look a lot different is we have to talk about the content sometimes. Like the keys really are the thing sometimes. Like we have to be able to make meaning out of the keys, not how we're talking about the keys, but about the keys themselves and where they go and what that says to each person about the relationship and about what they need. Right. So, there are times where I get really, we do get really granular about specific challenges, specific recurring conflicts or difficulties in the relationship. And we do, we definitely do these meaning making pieces, but we'll also do these pieces around, okay, so what, how can we problem solve, right? Is there a way that we can work together, accepting, having more acceptance of whatever difference between us tends to just not mesh well, right? Like in my case, sort of what I tend to do with the keys versus what my husband tends to do with the keys. Like we've built some acceptance for each other that like, that's who we are in the world, but how do we kind of come up with solutions together that honors that, you know? Mm-hmm. So in this case, like mostly I put the keys where they're supposed to go, but sometimes I don't, and he has more grace for me.
Right.
Now, I have more of a commitment and keep it more top of mind to put the keys where they go.
Curiosity is probably really integral to this, curiosity and an orientation toward understanding. Because again, for example, maybe the people you work with, it's really not, okay, somebody's right and somebody's wrong in this situation, but it could feel like that's what it's about when mm-hmm. people function differently and aren't trying or don't mm-hmm. aren't equipped, don't have the tools to really try to understand the person. Like you said, your husband told you, I need the keys here. And sometimes it's still hard to understand that if you don't have other language around it or contextualize it maybe in the ADHD or whatever else has mattered for you in that exact situation.
It's definitely important and helping couples practice. Like there's often times where I'll say, oh, it sounds like you have a question about that. And they'll be like, no. Like, okay. Can you come up with a question about that for your partner? I'm like, oh, okay. And sometimes it takes a minute, but kind of that practice of noticing when you're making a leap or when you've come to a conclusion and slowing down and asking, checking in with your partner instead, right? Which again is a skill we all need to be practicing. It's so easy to get ahead of ourselves and to come to conclusions, but when we can slow down and ask a question and get curious, and that curiosity has to extend to ourselves too, like about, wait, why is this important to me? Because I find that there's plenty of times where folks haven't been curious enough with themselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so sometimes it's curiosity about, well, wait, why do I really want this in the relationship? Why do I keep telling my partner to do this? Why do I keep, you know, feeling down when this doesn't happen in the relationship? But also, like, why do I need my space to be organized in this way? Why do I need to eat at this certain time of day, right? There's all these different pieces about how we go through the world and how we relate to other people that we're so acclimated to, you know, it's sort of like the fish stopping and noticing the water that they're swimming in. You know, it's hard to get, it's hard to really look at what we're immersed in every day. But when we can bring our curiosity to ourselves too, that really helps us be curious with our partners. And also, again, to tell stories, to get back to your tea, right? To be able to tell stories about things that our partner actually really needs to know and understand about who we are.
I think what's sticking out to me is this, you know, you talked about early on the framework for self-understanding and the framework, and now kind of coming back to this, yes, it's relational, but also again, like curiosity toward the other person, curiosity toward yourself as well. That feels like that's probably really challenging to navigate as you kind of are developing an understanding for yourself in the context of a relationship. You know, maybe you're changing or the way you're seeing the relationship is changing. So I wonder if you specifically, you know, speak to that at all of what it looks like to kind of do a lot of self-discovery in the context of a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and to go back to some of my own story, I feel like I've really lived that in a way that felt pretty intense and profound to me. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, now I'm a little distance out from the time where there was sort of like the most intensity around that for me, but I still am discovering new things about myself, and hopefully I always will. Right. But yeah. I try to hold in mind and try to help people normalize in terms of their meaning making, right?
Yeah.
And that self-discovery brings a lot of different feelings, right? It's not all good and exciting. Like, self-discovery can bring a lot of grief. It can bring a lot of shame. It can bring regret and guilt and confusion, right? And there can be, I think there's often sort of this process for people who go through really reorienting to themselves as neurodivergent or to someone significant in their life as neurodivergent. There's often this kind of roller coaster process that I feel like I've witnessed and lived my own versions of, where, you know, there's times where it's like, whoa, I'm like at the top of a mountain and this is like gorgeous and so exciting up here. And there's all this space and I'm so hopeful. And, but then there's other moments where it's just like, you're in the thick of like a dark and dense, you know, an uncharted jungle of some kind, and you're bushwhacking, or you need to like just sit down and take a break. And that whole process and like the ups and downs within it, it can be a lot of work. So I say things like, get rest, drink water, keep eating, you know, find people that you can really lean on during this time. And so sometimes that means helping people find support groups or online spaces, but sometimes it means just helping people identify, like, who are the people in my life already that are really the safe people and the people who I can trust the most to talk about things as I go through this. Sometimes it means helping them get an individual therapist, journaling, walking, all those kinds of exercise, all those kinds of things that are good for us become especially important, I think, when we're navigating a lot of self-discovery and a lot of like reorienting to something in the world around us. And that's also too where I like to bring in that self-compassion. As I mentioned, that's been a big part of my journey of really just helping people stop. And I always like to put a hand on my heart. I feel like that's just to me where I can slow down and notice myself and connect with myself, but really just to stop and say, like, wow, this is a lot that I'm going through, or wow, I have so much grief that I didn't know this sooner, or I have so much grief about missed opportunities, or so much shame and guilt about treated my partner when I didn't understand this. And when we can pause and acknowledge there's suffering here, there's pain here. And then we can remind ourselves, like, this is part of life. We call it common humanity and self-compassion. You know, this is part of life. Other people go through this. It doesn't mean it's not painful, but there's nothing wrong with us for feeling this way. We're humans in a messy world, figuring out something new about ourselves. And then, you know, the third part of that self-compassion practice is saying, how can I be kind to myself? So sometimes that means just being able to say a kind word or phrase. But sometimes that means saying, I'm going to binge a show on Netflix in bed tonight because I've got nothing left, given how hard I've been working mentally and emotionally and relationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That self-kindness piece does feel really important. And I, as you're talking, realize that maybe where I asked that question comes from, that a lot of self-discovery or growth for an individual happening in the context of a relationship seems like that could feel like a really scary thing or really unsettling. If you're doing deconstructing, if you're relating to things differently, you know, you want to have a relationship that's resilient and flexible enough to have space for that. And it takes me back to this idea that feels important for me, that, you know, when I talk about communication, still for so many people, there's this kind of outdated understanding that's based in what we call the transmission model. And that's person A talks at person B, and what's said, that's the communication. And there it is. And it's like, no, there's so much more going on. And, you know, it's not just what was said, it's also how it was said. But I don't even want to stop there. I'm like, it's so much more. Like, if you're person B in that situation, for instance, you're contributing to the communication as well, because how are you listening, and what kind of patterns are you creating? What kind of stories are you telling in the interaction? So I'm so cognizant of how we create, again, social constructionist perspective. We're the curious participants in the world. We have choices and personal power to an extent. And so how do we create the kind of relationships too that are resilient and flexible enough for us to grow and change and deconstruct and reconstruct what we need to? Because I think that that feels really important to me, that that's like a lifelong thing of understanding yourself in ever, you know, changing ways. And so if you can create relationships, again, whether you identify as someone that is neurodivergent or not, that feels like such an important tool.
Right. Which makes me think about, you're making me think about like a number of different pieces. And I mean, I think one of those is I've heard this stories told so often from clients, and I get where it comes from because I see it all the time out in the world too, is I think we have this idea that we have to know ourselves before we can be in a relationship. And I'm always like, I'm sorry, that doesn't happen. That's an illusion. You know, there's always more to discover about ourselves. We're never going to arrive there. And if we wait until we've arrived there to be in a relationship, it's never going to happen. Like, the experience of being in a relationship is inherently always also an experience of self-discovery, you know, and we have to get comfortable with doing both at the same time. And I think part of that, you know, getting comfortable with both is like challenging that narrative, right? Saying it's okay to be figuring yourself out 20 years into a marriage. Like, that's okay. People do that. It happens. It's, again, part of being human. It's part of life. But I think we also have to challenge this other idea that partners can and should be everything to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, that's problematic, again, for pretty much every couple I've ever met with in my office. It's definitely problematic for mixed neurotype couples and for folks who are having to like reorient to themselves and their relationship. You are not going to be able to be each other's only person through that. And there's going to be times where one or both of you have to kind of be in your own corners, doing your own work, grieving in your own ways, I didn't mention anger, right? Having your own anger that might need to come up. And so again, that's something I try to name and really talk about directly with couples, is like, when you're doing this work, sometimes it looks like you're going in different directions, but it's part of the process of being able to come back together. And that's okay. It's hard. It doesn't feel great. Especially a lot of times these couples have kids. Some of those kids are neurodivergent. So there's a lot of demands, right, outside of just the work and the relationship. So yeah, I mean, I think just a lot of acceptance of like relationships don't always feel stable. We don't always feel stable. Again, how do we find things that work for us within that instead of trying to make that not be true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's cool to be putting all these pieces together to kind of create a whole picture of what the work that you do is really about. Let me know if this is, you know, way too broad of a question, but as I kind of, this picture is kind of coming together, I want to make sure that we're touching on all the parts of it that you'd want to talk about. So my question, I guess, is what else, like what more is there that's, you know, in this work that we maybe haven't talked about yet today or that feels important? And especially I'm interested in this emphasis on that this is not just work for couples who are in mixed neurotype relationships, but, you know, what are some of those other tools that we maybe haven't talked about or orientations or, you know, any of it else that you would want to talk about from your work today?
I think we've covered a lot of my kind of main things that are most important to me or that I find most relevant.
I wonder if you have examples, maybe kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation, even about kind of step one being awareness or labeling or kind of gaining this language. I wonder if there's people that are listening who this is maybe new for them. Mm-hmm. And they're maybe still in that kind of like, well, I don't trying to recognize stage. And so I wonder if you have any stories from that kind of moment of what are some of the things that you could look out for? Maybe even like, let's go that basic. I know you have, you know, a specific experience with relationships with people with ADHD. Maybe that's even something you could speak to. But yeah, I just wonder if there's some stories or examples that you could share to help make this real for people. Kind of, you know, say the let's go back to what was unsaid that we kind of danced around. Oh, when people are neurodivergent, but let's try to really speak to that if you have some stories you could share.
Yeah. So I think part of what I can speak to about that is I'd say, yeah, it's hard to tell a specific story, but I think a really common theme, kind of the stories that I've heard the most often are the times where it's the neurotypical partner or the what we call allistic, the partner that's not autistic in the relationship, who's starts to recognize like, oh, maybe there's some neurodivergence here in my partner that we haven't named before, that we haven't understood together before. I think almost always, the experience, I guess I could say, like, this is true for me in some ways. I think particularly when I think about my relationship with my mom, less so when I think about my other, you know, relationships in the family I've created, just because ADHD was more of a known thing in a number of ways. But there's almost always this experience of like, this person is nice and I know they care about me, but something about the relationship feels off. I feel either like confused or invalidated or not quite supported in the ways I want to be. It's often this really vague, before you've put language to it and a framework to it, it's often this really vague kind of discomfort or dissatisfaction. And in my experience, again, with what I've witnessed, almost always people feel tremendous guilt about that. There's a sense of like, what's wrong with me? That I feel like something's, you know, off, or there's something I'm not understanding in this relationship. When this person is outwardly nice and lots of people seem to think they're a great spouse or partner, like what is wrong with me that I'm questioning this? So I would say to people who are listening to this, like if that's a feeling that you have, like please, please, please start doing a little digging into neurodiversity and see what that can open up. Because again, to go to those like untold stories, like that's such I'm struggling again with language, right? It's a really difficult place to be because it really challenges your ability to trust yourself. You know, again, to go back to my own story and just having this nagging feeling of something's not quite understood here. It really was a sense of not being able to fully trust myself or believe myself that grew out of that. And that's such a terrible place to be. It's such a disempowering place to be. It's confusing. It makes us hide from other people in our lives because we don't want to tell them what we're really thinking or feeling. You know, just create, it cuts us off and isolates us in so many different ways. So I feel like now I'm starting to go in almost this other direction. But so I would say that if you feel that in yourself in some way, you know, and if you've often these are people that have already looked at a number of other things of like, is this narcissism? Is this borderline personality disorder? Is this abuse? Like you might have looked at all these other things and been like, nothing fits. What's wrong with me? Right. Start looking at neurodiversity and consider that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great. And I'm thinking that, okay, that was kind of me asking you, like, okay, let's zoom in and let's get specific. But I do want to return to the systems thinking that you're really rooted in. And so kind of zooming out, and again, maybe this can be a part that speaks to people, neurodiverse relationships outside of, you know, romantic relationships, but friendships, workplace relationships, any of that, what's the kind of systems thinking 1,000-foot view of your work with neurodiverse relationships? Maybe kind of like contextually, how does it exist in the world? Or what are the larger stories that are being told there?
Yeah, there's a lot of things happening at the 10,000 foot level that end up impacting us on the very, very personal level. And I mean, in so many different ways, right? But to focus on neurodiversity in particular, I mean, we have a society that for a long time has told a story that basically there are no neurodivergent adults. Like that's been the story. It's been like 80 is the thing that kids have and it impacts them in school and then they grow out of it and it's not a big deal once they're adults. Or, you know, autism is something that kids get diagnosed with and it's, you know, if someone got diagnosed as a kid, then they, you know, then they go on to become an autistic adult. But largely we don't even talk about that, right? I mean, there's plenty of those folks in the world too. But what's really, really new, and we're still learning to talk about this and address this in all the ways, like in our mental health care, in our physical health care, in the way that we talk to one another in social media, right? We're still trying to figure out where there's like, I am a part of this world where this is happening. So I can feel like it's happening more than it is, but I do believe we're starting to expand and we're getting better, but it's still so unspoken that you can have neurodivergent adults who were never identified as kids. Mm. And they are all over the place. There's women with ADHD, women with autism, you know, adults with autism who maybe did well enough in school, but have had all these other struggles that they haven't been able to identify before. I mean, we need to talk about that. Like, people of color are less likely to be diagnosed with autism. Yeah. Probably also with ADHD, right? So there's all these other systemic inequalities, like testing and getting assessed for autism is incredibly expensive. Often insurance doesn't cover that. You know, so there's all these pieces that really impact who gets identified as neurodivergent and then what kind of services or supports they can access and what kind of accommodations we as a society think that person should have or need. So I often kind of think about if you're in a mixed neurotype relationship with someone who's a late identified, that's the term we tend to use, like a late identified adult who's either autistic or has ADHD, like that is somebody who spent their whole life probably getting criticized, getting rejected, shaming themselves, like finding ways to make themselves do things that were horribly uncomfortable or really, really difficult for them. I mean, that's somebody whose whole experience of themselves has been really convoluted and messed up by the way the whole world treated them. Yeah. And it hasn't ended now that they've been identified. Now they're still in a world that doesn't really acknowledge their existence or think in a compassionate, well-informed way about what their needs might be. I feel like I'm jumping on a number of different things, but I also just want to name, for example, like it is not uncommon to hear of people who might even go to a therapist or let's say even a psychologist for an assessment and be told, I've heard this from so many places now, be told either you make eye contact, so you can't be autistic, or you have a solid work history, so you can't have ADHD, or you graduated from college, so you can't have ADHD, or you're married, so you can't be autistic. This is in the mental health field. This is what people with like master's degrees and doctorate degrees are saying to their clients, their patients, like, oh my gosh, what people are hearing out in the world is way worse than that. So it's part of, you can probably hear like me getting really riled up as we're talking. It's because there's just so much systemic failure and injustice in terms of how neurodivergent people are treated and not supported. And that absolutely impacts relationships, right? When one person is having to fight all the time for their existence to be validated, or fight all the time to fit a mold that's really challenging for them to fit into, like that person is just not going to have as much energy left for the relationship. And they're going to come into the relationship with all kinds of trauma and fear of other people.
Yeah. I think all of that is, you say you're going off in a bunch of directions. All that feels relevant and important and, kind of making me have to take stock, like, okay, we're not going to, solve all the systemic problems in this 1 hour of conversation, but so good. Again, even the awareness, the language part, so good for us to be able to like name these things, like you said, because some people it feels maybe like you want to just be like hyper-focused, hyper-zoomed in on the relationship. But I do think both, I think the zooming in and talking about the specifics and the intimacies is really important. And also, like you said, that way broad systems thinking, if you can't name the way that your day-to-day life is affected by the larger system you're a part of and how that affects how you're showing up to your relationships or yourself, or that that you're missing that self-compassion piece, not just in your relationship but on a systemic level, there's not a lot of compassion, then that can really help. I guess just taking us back to the beginning of this conversation full circle with that naming piece being really valuable.
Which makes me also want to name the piece of like, it's true for neurotypicals and holistic folks too, right? That they're also being set up by society to not know how to have like compassion or to engage effectively with their partners, right? And so again, that meaning making, we have to keep going back to the fact that like both of you have been set up to fail in this relationship in a number of different ways. And that's not true of most other couples. Again, this is like a piece that is unique for mixed neurotype couples. Like you are getting set up by society in so many different ways to fail at this. And I sometimes use the term that this work is what I call like the relationship Olympics, because it takes so much strength and determination and practice, because you're doing it without the kind of support that so many other couples have. Like you can't borrow from those same scripts, tools, whatever, that are just floating around in the atmosphere. You have to really do your own work to know yourself, to know each other. And it's admirable. It's so beautiful to witness. It's so powerful. I feel like once you can do this, you can do anything. That's kind of why I think about it as the Olympics in that way too. But we have to be able to give folks in these relationships credit for how hard they're working and just how much they're like swimming upstream in our larger systemic picture of things in our culture and society.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, Lori, I really appreciate everything that you've shared today. As we wrap up, is there anything else, any note you want to leave us with?
I think as we wrap up, the main thing that I know I'm taking away and that I hope people can take away from this conversation is this piece that, like I said, it's so personal to me as well as something that I work with professionally so much. But just to name again, when there's neurodiversity in your life, in your relationships, maybe neurodivergence in yourself, and you don't know that, you can't tell your story. right? And when you know, you can begin to tell your story, and you can begin to tell the story of your relationship, the story of who you are as a person. And that is just, it's so powerful when you're able to do that. So again, perhaps just a word of encouragement to folks, if you're listening to this conversation and something about it is kind of piquing your curiosity, like, please listen to that. Please give yourself the opportunity to be able to tell your story, to be able to make some of those unknowns knowns, some of those untolds tellable, because it is so incredible to be able to do that. It's so life-changing. I'm so honored that I get to witness people do the work. And I'm also just continue to feel privileged all the time that I've been able to have my own lived experience of making a radical shift like this and all the ways it's freed me up and made my relationships so much better.
Yeah, it's so obvious to me that how meaningful this work that you do is. And so I'm so glad that, you know, we just got to even get a little taste of that in this conversation. So seriously, Lori, thank you so much for today.
Thanks so much for having me, Abby.
Okay, that is all for our conversation with Lori. As you know, I like to offer some questions to reflect on at the end of each episode. This acts as a next turn, so the conversation doesn't stop just because the episode does. Today, the questions I would have you think about are pretty simple, but really important ones. And they are, where in your relationships can you name the meaning you are making? And where can you ask others to name the meaning they are making? As I reflected back on this conversation, I just think that is the central piece of what Lori and I spoke about today. We all make meaning in different ways. And so the best chance we can give our relationships is to try to learn to name that meaning. And that is a lot easier said than done, but it's still a worthwhile endeavor, I think. So I'd really encourage you to think about those questions. Where can you try to name the meaning you're making, and where can you ask others to do the same? I really believe that that's a practice that can create a lot of clarity and is certainly something that's moving us toward better social worlds as we all coordinate and collaborate with each other. You're welcome to reach out to me to share your reflections on those questions. I'd love to be in conversation with you, and you could do that through email, the website, commenting on Instagram or YouTube, or interacting on the CMM Institute Substack, where you can also find all the episodes of this podcast. Links to all of those places are included in the show notes. So I'll point you there if you'd like to connect with me in one of those ways. The reason I invite you to share your reflections with me is to stay in dialogue. Other great ways to stay in dialogue are to follow the show wherever you listen, leave a rating and review, but most importantly to me, share this episode or any episode that's been meaningful with someone you want to invite into the conversation. I'm supported by the CMM Institute for Personal and Social Evolution. This podcast is just one of many initiatives designed to create space for more conversations that move us toward those better social worlds we hope to create. You can learn more about the CMM Institute and our other initiatives at the links in the show notes. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being curious, and thank you for being a part of this story. I'm Abby, and this has been Stories Lived, Stories Told.